How's volume sound? Mic says good, okay. All right. Okay, well, welcome back. Tonight it's Lincoln's War, and I hope you had a chance or will have a chance to read the readings on there, especially the essay by Murray Rothbard, and the one by Ostrowski is very good as far as a legal constitutional analysis of the war. And I thought I don't want to just repeat what's in my book chapter tonight. You can read that for yourselves. So I brought a few other references that I'm going to talk about. But the first thing I thought I'd mention is, and Rothbard talks about this, and some of the other, I think one or two of the other essays talk about that, is that the international law had evolved in the 19th century for the previous several centuries, to the point where it was commonly agreed and was codified in whatever laws there were that countries agreed to, that it's illegitimate to intentionally target civilians in warfare and to steal private property. It was acknowledged, though, that it's inevitable if there's a war, some civilians will get killed and injured, and some private property will be stolen, but it was considered to be a war crime to intentionally go out and break into someone's house, steal their valuables, shake them down, hang them by their thumbs until they tell you where the silverware is, which is the sort of thing that Sherman's army did. That was acknowledged all around the world as being war crimes. And a good discussion of this, it's very readable, is in a book by Charles Adams called When in the Course of Human Events. I'll hold it up to the camera there, Charles Adams. And he did his research there, there's about a 5 or 6 page discussion that summarizes the laws of warfare beginning 500 years ago and up to the time that he wrote the book. But there was actually a convention in Geneva, Switzerland in 1863 that countries that sent delegates there codified what had been evolving for centuries about the rules of warfare. And one of the funny things, I think it's funny about my critics about my Lincoln research, is I mentioned this, and I quote Charles Adams, and so these people for years were on the web saying, oh, DiLorenzo thinks the 1946, or whatever it was, Geneva Convention applied to the Civil War. Well, it was a convention in Geneva, Switzerland in 1863. If you really want to read about this, there's a book edited book of essays by about 30 authors. It's called The Laws of War, published in 1994, Yale University Press. So if anybody happens to be interested in this whole business, that seems to be a pretty good summary. But here's what the Laws of Warfare said as of the 1860s. This was a convention that was held in Geneva, Switzerland, 1863. One, attacking defenseless cities and towns is a war crime. So there's no army there, and another army bombs it or burns it, attacks it, that's a war crime. Two, plundering and wantonly destroying civilian property is a war crime. And then three, only necessities could be taken from a civilian population, and they had to be paid for. And so the countries, governments engaging in warfare said you can take necessities from civilians, but you have to offer them something. And of course, if they're offering you something, it's take it or leave it. So it's not exactly a market transaction. But that's where it stood. That's where it stood. And one of the excuses that the Lincoln administration always made is that, well, we were not a signatory to that. Therefore, we didn't have to abide by these laws. Although there would be a generally accepted laws of civilization. And that's the exact same argument that the Nazis made at the Nuremberg trials. They said Russia never signed on to these, by that time, by the 1940s, what these conventions had said. Therefore, if we committed war crimes against the Russians, we, the Nazis, should not be held responsible for it. Lincoln made the same arguments many decades earlier, and today his defenders make the same argument too. After my book came out, I was bombarded with emails from people saying exactly this, we never signed on to this in the United States. Therefore, we can do whatever we want. We can kill our own civilians. We can bomb our cities, and so forth. Never seeming to think that it was more than just a legalism. It's a moral issue of intentionally murdering civilians. But I could never get through to these people, as far as that goes. And so, if you want this, an extra reading, it's a very readable thing on one of the Mises groups, chat groups, a couple months ago. Someone was asking, where's a good libertarian summary of the laws of war? And that's what I recommended. And so the next thing I thought I'd do is there's another book that's published fairly recently, a couple years ago, called War Crimes Against Southern Civilians. You want to read some depressing work. And the author is Walter Brian Sisko. And Walter Brian Sisko used as his sources the official records of the War of the Rebellion. And I think I might have mentioned these records in the class before. People, historians who do research on the Civil War and the battles and all that, this is what they use. Good university libraries usually have the whole collection of the official records. It's all the reports by all the generals and the other officers of what happened. It's government documents. And so if you're a researcher in this area, this is what you use, among other things. And so he documented what was going on in the war crimes. So it's a book about the violations of those three tenets of the laws of war that I mentioned. And the way the Lincoln administration violated that is they had their own code of warfare. It's called the Lieber Code, L-I-E-B-E-R. Named after a man named Francis Lieber, who was a German immigrant who worked for the Lincoln administration. And I quote him in my book as expressing just the unmitigated hatred for Thomas Jefferson and the whole idea of decentralized government. He was a German nationalist who came to America, and he wanted to teach Americans the virtues of big activist centralized government in the spirit of Alexander Hamilton. And so, and Lincoln hired him as his to write the military code for the United States Army. And he wrote it like any good lawyer would, with plenty of loopholes in it so that it could be easily avoided. But by 1864, General Grant was just totally ignoring the whole thing, and the other generals too. There was no code of warfare at all by the Union Army at that point. And my own hunch as to why this was that once you go down the road of intentionally murdering civilians, bombing cities, and so forth, you're a war criminal. And if you lose, you will be tried as a war criminal and maybe hanged. So all these generals understood that that once they started committing war crimes, they darn well better win this war. And so it turned into a very vicious war of extermination against the Southern people, not just a war against combatants. And Brian Sisko documents a lot of this ugly history very well written. I've met him. He's a very careful researcher. And these things are the things, I'm convinced that one of the reasons why so many of the Lincoln writers write these really extraordinarily flaky, sentimental, sappy stories about what a gentle little lamb Abraham Lincoln was, and how he suffered. He had mental illness, and he took mercury pills, and on and on and on. And Harold Holzer, the well-known Lincoln scholar, I've seen him on TV on several occasions, literally crying. He was acting, but he had tears coming out of his eyes, talking about the suffering of poor old Abe. I think it's all a cover-up because they don't want to talk about all the war and the death that occurred at the hands of Lincoln. They want to divert everyone's attention from all the death and destruction that took place and the grotesque nature of it. Just a few examples. Here's a discussion in Chapter 11 of Brian Sisko's book on the shelling of Charleston, South Carolina, which is where I was last weekend for a couple of days. Of course, the Union Army hated Charleston as much as anywhere. They probably hated Columbia, South Carolina, the most, but also Charleston, because that's where the secession movement got started. And here's a description of the bombing of Charleston. And I'll just read it. The first projectiles were fired from a huge iron Parrott gun mounted on a framework of logs floating on the marsh just inland from Morris Island, dubbed the Swamp Angel. This rifled behemoth burst and discharged 36 rounds, its powder charge having been dangerously increased. Soon, a federal battery of four guns was under construction on a tiny piece of dry ground surrounded by a marsh called Black Island. Firing on the city began with regularity in November and increased dramatically after the first of the year, assisted by additional artillery. During one nine-day period in January, no fewer than 1,500 shells fell on the city. Later, a single gun nearby threw 4,253 missiles into Charleston before it, the gun, burst. This was a city occupied by civilians. There was no army there. It was just the city occupied by civilians. And day after day after day, hundreds or thousands of artillery shells landing in Charleston, South Carolina. Now I'll read one more paragraph. On Christmas Day of 1863, William Knighton, 83 years old, and his sister-in-law were sitting in front of a hearth in his home when a shell came crashing through the roof. His leg was shot off below the knee, and a fragment of the same projectile crushed his sister-in-law's foot. Within a week, both had died from their wounds. The Christmas Day shelling of Charleston was the heaviest thus far, making it obvious that the bombardment had no military purpose, but was meant to strike terror into the civilian population. Gilmore has admitted as much. He's talking about a general. No military results of great value were ever expected, he told his superiors, though the results were not only highly interesting and novel, but very instructive of what they could do. And so these were people that, you know, there were old men and women and children in their homes. And they were bombing them with hundreds, thousands of shells day in and day out. Another example of the type of thing that went on here. On April 24th, 1864, Brian Sisko quotes one of the letters in the official records from a General Richard Taylor about this, about Louisiana. The destruction of this country by the enemy, this is a Confederate general, he's actually Zachary Taylor's son, Richard Taylor. The destruction of this country by the enemy exceeds anything in history. For many miles, every dwelling house, every Negro cabin, every cottage gin, every corn crib, and even chicken houses have been burned to the ground, every fence torn down, and the fields torn up by the hoofs of horses and wheels on wagons. Many hundreds of persons are utterly without shelter, but for our prompt attacks, Natchitoches, Louisiana, would have been burned to the ground, and also the little village of Cloversville, both of them having been fired on in several places. That's just one spotty example. One final example I'll give of Sherman in Atlanta. Now this was what happened in Atlanta. Was again, there was no Confederate army left, and so Sherman is there, and for 4 days they essentially had target practice on private homes. If they would see people moving around somewhere through their binoculars, they would, you know, try to have target practice with their artillery, and standing a mile away or so from the city. And so here's what Brian Sisko writes: Sherman ordered heavy artillery to be sent by rail from Chattanooga. Quote, with which we can pick out almost any house in the town, he boasted. That's Sherman talking. Sherman said this: let me know if the 4.5-inch guns have come and where you will place them. He wrote Major General George H. Thomas on August 8th. I would like to have them at work tomorrow. Every Union gun within range of the city, 223 cannons of all size, open fire on August 9th. And again, there's no army there. They're not shooting at an army. As many as 5,000 rounds of shot and shell fell in Atlanta that one day, the heaviest bombardment ever inflicted on an American city. It went on day and night for another 3 weeks. Six members of one family were killed by a direct hit on their shelter. A 42-pound shell crashed through the roof of the Presbyterian Church on Marietta Street penetrated the floor and exploded in a basement Sunday school room crowded with those seeking shelter. Imagine how terrifying that must have been. Miraculously, no one was killed, though one man lost his right arm. Another shell hit the sidewalk on Alabama Street, mortally wounding black barber Salomon Lucky as he stood outside his shop. One lady was killed instantly by an explosion on the street in front of the express office. There seemed to be no end to the carnage. During the shelling, one surgeon reported having performed 107 amputations on men, women, and children. And these were all old men who were not in the Army, and women and children. And so these are the type of things no one has ever taught in school. No one has ever heard of this. But this is what happened. This was the total war that was going on. Let's see, I'm just reading some of the comments here. Linda's not picking up the video. I hope so. I just checked the video. I asked about video. I guess Linda might be having a problem. But I'll keep on going. And so, I mean, this you know, you can tell stories like this continually. In my book chapter on this called Waging War on Civilians, I quoted a book by Mark Greeley, Jr. called The Hard Hand of War. And he's a pretty good researcher. He's a defense researcher. He's a consultant for the U.S. Department of Defense. And I quote him, the facts that he brings in there. And so some of the soldiers that were doing some of the looting and pillaging were taken out of the jails of the northern states, literally. And they were combined with mercenaries from Europe who also came out of jails. And some of the European governments told people, that you can be paid a bounty if you go join the U.S. Army. We'll put you on a boat, send you over there, and let you out of jail. And they did. And so it took a special kind of soldier to do that, to do the pillaging and plundering. If you read the stories of Sherman's March, and his soldiers were called bummers, they pillaged and plundered and looted their way through South Carolina and Georgia. You can read about it in my book chapter. Shelby Foote's famous trilogy, The Civil War, has really a chapter and verse about this. They stole things from the slaves as well as everybody else. They murdered some of the slaves if they wouldn't tell them where the family hid the valuables, where they buried the silverware. General Benjamin Butler had the nickname Spoons Butler because he was famous for gathering up silverware, spoons, knives, forks, and hauling them home. And there must have been some vast wagon trains and train loads of property. Sherman himself boasted in his memoirs that his men stole about $20 million worth of private property, clothing, jewelry, pianos, silverware, anything of value, beds, furniture, and so forth, and took it off. Of course, a lot of livestock. You read about these accounts, a lot of livestock was stolen or destroyed as well. Family dogs and everything was shot. So it was quite the ugly rampage. And I don't need to really say any more about it. I gave you, there's enough in my book chapter. If you want to read my book chapter, there's enough ugliness there about the waging war on civilians. And so I even quote a historian named Lee Kennett, who's a biographer of Sherman, as saying that had the South won the war, they would have been justified, he says, in hanging Lincoln and the entire Union Army High Command as war criminals for waging war on civilians under the international law and under just the rules of civilization. And this is a pro-Lincoln Sherman biographer, Lee Kennett, who wrote a book, Marching Through Georgia, on that. So it's widely acknowledged by a lot of the mainstream historians that these were war crimes, but they always seem to make the argument that the ends justify the means, the Union was saved, slavery ended, and so forth. I also quote in my writings some other people, such as James Randall, who does what a lot of these authors do, and they use the Hitler-Stalin criteria. They'll say, well, yes, these things happened, but it wasn't as bad as Hitler and Stalin. And of course, if you use that as your benchmark, that's a pretty low benchmark to achieve. And I think it's pretty widely acknowledged that this was a break from how civilization had been evolving in terms of warfare. And also, of course, if you go back long enough in history with regard to warfare, democracy was a very bad thing as far as that goes. Because when the war was between the kings of Europe, the war was between their mercenary armies, and you had battles between armies. But with the advent of democracy and nationalism, wars became wars of countries, my country versus your country. And the whole idea that the people were behind the war, not just the king. It wasn't just one monarch trying to steal the wealth of the other monarch and hiring a mercenary army to do so. It was the people involved. And once the people were involved and responsible, the thinking was it is illegitimate to target the people and bomb the cities and so forth. So there was much more pillage and carnage of the population with democracy. But still, if you read Charles Adams' description of the evolution of international law, it was widely declared to be illegal and a war crime to do that sort of thing. And so the Lincoln administration really broke the mold there, and they resurrected the whole idea of waging total war on a civilization, civilians including armies, because it had become more civilized, if you can call war civilized, over the centuries. And it also set the stage for the 20th century. they're the model, the role model for what has happened in the 20th century. And I've had, when my book came out, I had a few debates and some of the speeches I gave in the universities here and there. And neocons or neoconservatives would come up to me and they would tell me that this was a good thing. It was a good thing that they waged total war in the South because it helped us win World War II, because we waged total war on the German population and dropped the atomic bomb on Japan and, murdered, hundreds of thousands of civilians. That was a good thing, they tell me. And so that, I would argue that if we didn't establish that precedent, for one thing, there might not have been a World War I and a World War II if our government didn't do what it did in the 1860s. But also mass murder. I've told these people, I can remember talking to a neoconservative at Grove City College several years ago where I gave a talk on Lincoln, and just telling them, mass murder of civilians is mass murder of civilians. It's immoral, it's a crime, no matter what the ends is. The means don't justify the ends. You're talking about murder. So that's pretty widely acknowledged that this happened. And you have people defending this. And so the next thing I'd like to do is I'm going to talk about the precedent this set immediately in terms of the U.S. government. This was a very, very big step on the way to transforming the government into an empire. And I'm going to talk about one of my recent academic publications. This is what it looks like. It's a reprint here. It's in the Independent Review. And the title of the article is The Culture of Violence in the American West, Myth versus Reality. And I think it's online by now. They sometimes don't put the articles online for a couple of months to encourage you to actually buy the journal. But it's probably online at independent.org, the website of the Independent Institute. And it's an elaboration of an article that's pretty well known among libertarians. That was published some years ago by Terry Anderson and P.J. Hill, and it was their article is called The Not-So-Wild Wild West, where they documented that contrary to the popular culture and some of the history books, the Wild West was really not that wild. That people, even before there were governments set up, the wagon trains, the mining camps, they set their own constitutions, their own rules. They didn't want to live among violent criminals. They have their own private law enforcement, their own rules. If you were a thief or a violent person on the wagon trains, you would be kicked out and sent home, for example, by the other members of the wagon train. And so Anderson and Hill made the case that the civil society of the Wild West, there was crime, there were gunslingers, but it was pretty mild compared to today. But anyway, the argument I make in this article is I reviewed their literature and other literature that came after them on the civil society, and I make the case that there was a lot of violence in the American West in the post-Civil War years, but the real violence came from the Army, the U.S. Army, in its war on the Plains Indians. So I thought that rather than rehashing what I wrote in The Real Lincoln on about waging war on civilians or the reading list, which you could all read for yourself, I thought I'd talk a little bit about what all the very same generals, the very same military officers did just a couple of months after the Civil War was over. And so what happened was 3 months after Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox in April of 1865, Sherman was put in charge of the Military District of the Missouri, which was all the land west of the Mississippi. And so Grant put him in charge of that. And his job was to clear the Plains Indians out of there to make way for the railroads. And in my article, I quote Sherman himself as saying this, that he said that he turned his attention immediately to the railroad, making way for the railroads. And the top engineer, the head engineer of the government subsidized Transcontinental Railroads, was Grenville Dodge, an old friend of Lincoln's, who Lincoln had made a general during the war. And if you have time to read the essay by Murray Rothbard, he mentions tonight's syllabus, he mentions Grenville Dodge as being a friend of Lincoln. He was not the military man, but he was nevertheless made a general, and his job was to kill some Indians during the war, to get them out of the way, and to start building the railroad. Lincoln was an old railroad lawyer, after all, a wealthy railroad lawyer, and that's what he was up to here. And so after the war, immediately after the war, Rothbard quotes Grenville Dodge as proposing to make slaves out of the Indians. This is after the war. This is after the 13th Amendment was passed that ended slavery. But the Indians apparently weren't considered to be human beings in the mind of Grenville Dodge. He said this. Here's what he said. He wanted to force them, quote, to do the grading on the railroad beds, with the army furnishing a guard to make the Indians work and keep them from running away. The U.S. government decided not to make slaves out of the Indians. They decided to murder as many of them as possible instead to get them out of the way. And Sherman and Grant were in charge of that. And this is another part of history that's been distorted. I've been reading recently, there was one article by a historian named Sean Wilentz, W-I-L-E-N-Z. He teaches at Princeton. Tom Woods eviscerated something he said. If you go on to, I think it was lewrockwell.com, and type in Tom Woods and Sean Wilentz, if you can imagine the two of them sword fighting, you can imagine Tom Woods with his sword chopping off his head, then both arms and both legs, and then walking away. It was a devastating critique of this guy, on an unrelated topic to this. But anyway, he wrote an article when someone was proposing taking Ulysses Grant off the $50 bill and putting Ronald Reagan. He threw a fit in the New York Times over it, and they talked about what a racial healer he was. Well, it was Grant who, for many years, first as general, then as president, supervised the 25-year campaign of genocide against the Plains Indians. He and Sherman and the whole group. So I'm going to give you a few quotes from, there's an author, a historian named Michael Fellman. If you're ever interested in reading books on Sherman's March, a biography of Sherman, who he was, Michael Fellman is a pretty good writer and a good historian. So, and I would recommend, if you want to read a book about Sherman, it's a good one. Look up his book. Excuse me. He quotes Sherman as using these words: "A final solution of the Indian problem is to, quote, killing hostile Indians and segregating their pauperized survivors in remote places." Now, that was General Sherman. So it's kind of creepy that he uses these words as the final solution to the Indian problem. Of course, that's what Hitler used to describe the Holocaust. And Here's what Feldman says about all the Grant, Sherman, Sheridan, Custer, all these generals, that these men applied their shared ruthlessness born of their Civil War experiences against the people all three despised. Sherman's overall policy was never accommodation and compromise, but vigorous war against the Indians, whom he regarded as a less than human and savage race, end quote. And he goes on to say that all of these generals were, quote, like Sherman and Sheridan, Civil War luminaries. And he mentions John Pope, O.O. Howard, Nelson Miles, Alfred Terry, E.O.C. Ord, C.C. Augur, Edward Canby, George Armstrong Custer, Benjamin Garrison, Winfield Scott Hancock, and on and on and on. So all the same generals and other officers who spent several years waging war on Southern civilians went to war against not only the Indian combatants, the Braves, but the women and children also. And here's here's what Feldman, another author on Sherman, another good book on Sherman is by John Marzalek. It's spelled M-A-R-S-Z-A-L-E-K. And these are the kind of books that if you go to any Borders bookstore, there's a place like that, and you look at the Civil War section, you'll find John Marzalek and Feldman, their books. And he says this, Sherman viewed the Indians as he viewed recalcitrant Southerners during the war and newly freed people after the war. That is, they were resistors to the legitimate forces of an ordered society, end quote. And then he goes on to describe the type of warfare that was being practiced. And he says, during the Civil War, Sherman and Sheridan had practiced a total war of destruction of property, private property. Now the army, in its Indian warfare, often wiped out entire villages, which they did. Continuing the quote, Sherman insisted that the only answer to the Indian problem was all-out war of the kind he had utilized against the Confederacy. This is Marzalek writing this. Since the inferior Indians refused to step aside so superior American culture could create success and progress, they had to be driven out of the way as the Confederates had been driven back into the Union. Let's see. And if you get into this, if you read Sherman's memoirs, as I have, and you get into the books about Sherman, it's kind of stomach-turning. The editor of this journal is Robert Higgs, the economist, economic historian, the Independent Review. And when he accepted the article for publication, he said, it turns my stomach, but I'll publish it anyway. As you read things like this, Sherman called what he was doing a, quote, racial cleansing of the land. He said, Lee Kennett is another good, he wrote a book called Marching Through Georgia. If you want to read a book about Sherman's march, this is a pretty good one, Lee Kennett, spelled with a K. The Indians give a fair illustration of the fate of the Negroes. This is Sherman. If they are released from the control of the whites, Sherman said. He believed that intermarriage of whites and Indians would be disastrous, Sherman did, as he claimed it was in New Mexico, where, quote, and he's quoting Sherman now, the blending of races had produced general equality, which led inevitably to Mexican anarchy, end quote. That was General Sherman he's quoting. And I put this in the article because I was sort of wanted to respond to something that a neoconservative writer named Victor Davis Hanson wrote in the American Enterprise magazine, published by the American Enterprise Institute some years ago. And he's a Straussian, which means he just makes stuff up. And he claimed that Sherman did what he did because he was an early egalitarian. He had lived in the South, which he did. He was a banker in Mississippi before the war. And he was outraged by the inequality between the black and white races. And so he did what he did in the murdering civilians and burning down towns and so forth, to seek personal revenge over all the inequality that he saw when he lived in Mississippi. And this, of course, is complete and total nonsense. Sherman, there's nothing Sherman ever said or did would lead anybody in their wildest imaginations to think that this was what motivated Sherman. If you look at both his words and his deeds, But he was as much a white supremacist as anybody else. He used the language of the final solution of the Indian problem. He called Mexicans mongrels because they had intermarried with Indians and blacks, and on and on and on. More great moments in American statesmanship from General Sherman. He said this: "All the Indians will have to be killed or maintained as a species of paupers," he announced. Sherman ordered his men to prosecute the war with vindictive earnestness until the Indians are obliterated or beg for mercy. And so what they did during the Indian Wars, all the same generals, all the same, they still have the blue uniforms on. They attacked, if you were to dig up some of the sort of the scholarship on the Indian Wars, you'll find that there were more than 1,000 attacks on Indian villages. This is between 1865 and 1890, roughly. Because the buffalo were the main source of everything. They were the main source of food, clothing. They even used the sinews from the dried sinews as bowstrings. They used the tiny bones from the buffalo as fish hooks. The Indians used the buffalo for everything. They even used the buffalo in the wintertime in the plains when it was below 0 Fahrenheit. They would kill a buffalo, gut it, and put the babies, the infants, inside where it was warm, keep them from freezing to death, if you read into this literature. And so the Plains buffalo were almost exterminated, not just because of what economists call the tragedy of the commons. No one owned the buffalo, they were out there in the open plain, and you could sell a buffalo hide for about $3 a hide, and so hunters would go out and shoot them 100 or more a day, skin them, take the hides, ship the hides back east, and make a lot of money. That was the main reason for the near extermination of the buffalo, but it was also government policy to bring people out there to mass kill the buffalo as a way of starving out the Indians, which they did. There were a group of Texans once, I quote, a group of Texans as approaching General Sheridan to complain about this. And here's what Sheridan said. He said, "Let them, the hunters, let them kill, skin, and sell until the buffalo is exterminated, as it is the only way to bring lasting peace and allow civilization to advance," end quote. So it was clearly the policy of the U.S. government to starve the Indians out. A notorious example of what went on is the Sand Creek Massacre, S-A-N-D, Sand Creek Massacre. And a source here of this is a book called Crimson Prairie, The Indian Wars, published in 1972, and the author is a man named S.L.A. Marshall. S.L.A. Marshall was the government's chief military historian of the European theater of the war in World War II. He wrote 45 books on U.S. military history. So this is a man who has some authority when he's writing books on military history. And so here's what U.S. Army officer in charge. What was happening was there was an Indian village of Arapaho Indians that had made peace with the U.S. government. The U.S. government told them, "Fly our flag, and we know that you are peaceful Indians, and we will leave you alone." So they did. This Captain Shivington, however, near Denver, rode out of Denver and issued the following orders. I want you to kill and scalp all the Indians, big and little. Nits make lice, so don't leave the little ones, the young ones. They'll grow up and create problems, and so they will. And here's how Marshall described what went on. He said, "Shivington's troops began a full day given over to bloodlust, orgiastic mutilation, rapine, and destruction, with Shivington looking on and approving." Marshall, end quote. Marshall noted that the number of Indians killed was 163, of which 110 were women and children. And this was during the Civil War. This was 1864. This was not after. This was during the Civil War. So this is Lincoln's army during the war. They were already making way for the railroads by killing the Indians. The point I make in my article here is to illustrate what happened. There's a famous book called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by Dee Brown, D-E-E, Dee Brown. Dee Brown, the famous historian of the American West. And here's how he described what happened at Sand Creek. When the troops came up to the squaws, they ran out and showed their persons to let the soldiers know they were squaws, and they begged for mercy. But the soldiers shot them all. There seemed to be indiscriminate slaughter of men, women, and children. The squaws offered no resistance. Everyone was scalped. So this is the U.S. Army scalping women. And it's even more grotesque than that. I'm not going to gross everyone out. If you want to read it, read Marshall's book. But it gets really barbaric, much more barbaric. Custer, of course, was involved in all of this, and Custer had orders from Sherman to not distinguish between men, women, and children. He said it would take too long. It'd be too dangerous to sit around and decide who to kill, who not to kill, so just kill everyone. That was essentially. Now here's what, and this came from Sherman then to Sheridan, and here's what General Philip Sheridan said during the Indian Wars. He said his orders, quote, kill or hang all the warriors, and doing that, quote, meant separating them from the old men, women, and children. This work was too slow and dangerous for the cavalrymen. They found it much more efficient and safe to kill indiscriminately. So that's what Sheridan said, Sheridan said was going on here. Marshall, SLA Marshall, he calls Sheridan's orders to Custer, quote, the most brutal orders ever published to American troops. And this is a man who wrote 45 books on American military history and was the government's official historian of the European theater of war in World War II. So that is a very powerful statement coming from a man like that. And when all is said and done, there's a book, if you want to find out how many Indians were killed, there are different estimates. There's an author named Russell Thornton who wrote a book in 1990 about the Indian Wars. He estimated from government records that about 45,000 Indians, including women and children, were killed during the Indian Wars. Okay, and so it doesn't say much by modern standards, but so that's what the U.S. Army set about to do. Another thing that happened during the Indian Wars is that the former black soldiers who were called buffalo soldiers by the Indians were employed. Many of whom were veterans of the Civil War and were employed after the wars to engage in this war of genocide against another colored race, the Redskin Indians. And so they've made movies about the Buffalo Soldiers. There are monuments to them. But what were they doing? They were engaging in this campaign of genocide, primarily, according to Sherman, for the benefit of the railroad corporations, to make way for the railroads. It's very telling to me that when the Indians were cornered, they would go to Canada. They felt safe in Canada. And then they would sneak back into the United States to their hunting grounds, and then if the U.S. Army had them cornered again, that's where they would try to escape to Canada. And so there's a lot of carnage there that happened. And this, in addition to what happened during the Civil War, laid the groundwork for what would go on in the 20th century, as far as that goes. And so maybe one more quote. Quote from Von Mises that might, I've had enough quotes for tonight, I guess. But I guess the point I wanted to make here is, with these readings, is that this really did fundamentally transform the whole U.S. government when the military became so barbaric. Look at what it did to the Southerners first and then to the Indians later. It would later, just a few decades later, would do something similar to the Filipinos. During the Spanish-American War and after the Spanish-American War, when there was a Filipino revolt against American occupation, we got rid of the Spanish Empire for them, and we impose our own empire, and they didn't like that. And so under Teddy Roosevelt, some 200,000 Filipinos were killed for resisting being part of the U.S. Empire. And that's why the Indians were killed, and that's why the Southerners had to be wiped out by the hundreds of thousands also, in my opinion. And so that's why there's, and a lot of this is discussed in a very famous, the consequences of this type of behavior are discussed in a very famous essay by William Graham Sumner. I think the title is the Conquest of America by Spain, or the Conquest of the United States by Spain. William Graham Sumner was a well-known Yale University intellectual sociologist, I suppose, by training. He was a great libertarian of the late 19th, early 20th century. And what he meant, of course, was that when the U.S. got into the Spanish-American War in the late 19th century, they became Spain. They became an empire like Spain. And so even though Spain lost the war, that's when U.S. became an empire. But I would argue that the behavior of the U.S. military during the Civil War and in the 25 years after, with the war in the Plains Indians by the same army, laid the groundwork for that. And it looks like, I guess that's enough of lecturing for now. It's been 47 minutes, and maybe before the class, I ran off. We only had two questions at that time when I printed off the questions. So I'll go around and read. I'll look at these questions first that I printed out, and see if anybody has any others. Here's one by Rob Mack. I'll read. He says, this course is about history, politics, and economics, not psychology. But do you think Lincoln was fascinated by war itself? He got involved in day-to-day Union strategy and tactics, though he had practically no military experience and none at higher command levels. That's true. The only experience Lincoln had is he supposedly was a participant in the Black Hawk Wars as a young man, which wasn't really much of a war. The historians claim he was a very, very, such a gentle soul, though, that he once saw a turkey shot and he cried. Anyway, the question said he's also very interested in the weapons used by the military. Was there more of a cold calculation of the economic and political impact of letting the South leave the Union? So he's asking about Lincoln's interest in weapons for the most part. Well, I've read a bit about this. Lincoln did tinker around with bigger and bigger weapons of mass destruction. There's a really nice little book on Lincoln, although it's called The Lincoln No One Knows by Webb Garrison. Webb Garrison wrote, I think, 35 books on Lincoln, the Civil War, and so forth. And each chapter is a query. And it's endorsed in the back by James McPherson, who's as mainstream as you get. But the chapters are things like, chapter 20, how did he develop enthusiasm for testing weapons of every kind and size? So which he did. So Webb Garrison documents how Lincoln did. He's sort of like the guy in the James Bond movies who's constantly creating the weapons for James Bond. Lincoln seemed to be kind of like that. He had bigger and bigger cannons that could fire bigger and bigger bombs at Charleston and things like that. I don't know why he was, Webb Garrison says he doesn't know why he was like that. I could guess that by the end of the war, he knew that he too was a war criminal, and that if he didn't win the war, he could be hanged as a war criminal. And the Southerners certainly would have hanged him had they won the war. And so I think that probably was a good motivation to produce bigger and bigger bombs and bigger cannons. And to and I quote in The Real Lincoln, James McPherson is bragging of what a brilliant micromanager of the war effort Lincoln was. McPherson says he spent more time in the War Department telegraph office than any other president in American history. And so I quote McPherson as saying that, to make the point that he knew everything that was going on. He knew all about all the murder of the civilians and the bombing of cities on and on and on from the very beginning. And also, quote Sherman himself in his memoirs as saying, "When after Sherman's march was all over, Sherman met with Lincoln on the James River in Virginia, and Sherman's words are, when Sherman explained to him the pillaging and plundering by the so-called bummers, he said Lincoln especially enjoyed those stories." And those are Sherman's words, "especially enjoyed." And you got to wonder what kind of man would enjoy stories like that. And so I can't psychoanalyze Lincoln. I think that's what the question is. Let me see if there's some, read some of the questions here. Mike is asking, is there a complete recommended bibliography associated with the class? Well, I have reading lists certainly on the class syllabus is online. My book, Lincoln Unmasked, I have an appendix in it, and I think I entitled it Books They Don't Want You to Read. So for each chapter, I put several books or articles on there if you want to dig up a reading list there. But you know, each class has several reading lists, of course. Let's see if we have some more questions here. And Dennis mentions, you know, we live close to Orchard Lake, Michigan, where he said war is hell. Well, you know, he does. That's how Sherman tried to dismiss what he was doing. Brian Sisko, who I quoted earlier, the author of the book War Crimes Against Southern Civilians, he makes the point that when you have a nonchalant attitude like that, war is hell, well, that sort of encourages this sort of thing to happen in the future. But if you oppose this and you come out against it and you say this is immoral, this is wrong, you could make it less likely to happen in the future. And so when you have the attitude and you support the idea that war is hell, don't criticize this, if anything, you make it more likely to happen again. The intentional waging of war on civilians. Let's see, Tim. I got Tim here. Is early in the war, a general told Jefferson Davis, "Give me 10,000 more men, and I'll take Washington." Yeah, I know that story. That's Stonewall Jackson. That was after the Battle of First Manassas. Stonewall Jackson got his name, Stonewall Jackson, at the Battle of First Manassas. But at that moment, this was at the very end of the war, the Confederates have won the battle, Jefferson Davis shows up on the battlefield, and this unknown, who wasn't a general yet, even Stonewall Jackson, Thomas Jackson, comes up to him, and Jackson was kind of a peculiar person, and he said that, give me 10,000 men and I'll take Washington tomorrow. And when I read that in a biography of Jackson, it's one of those, wow, what if he had done that? And the war would have ended right there, and it could have. If you ever read about the aftermath of the Battle of First Manassas, it was a disastrous defeat with the Confederates lobbing bombs at the whole Union Army as it ran back to D.C. with tail between its legs, and it could have ended the whole thing right there. So that was Thomas Jackson, Stonewall Jackson. Let's see. Questions. The bison were central to the Indian religion and culture. That's true. Let's see. So Dennis, pre-Gettysburg, before they hired Meade to lead the Army of the Potomac, they offered it to John Reynolds, who refused because of Halleck and Lincoln constantly interfering. And he was sure, I guess he's given us some history there. Okay. That's in the movie Gettysburg. It's a famous scene that the sniper shooting of Reynolds, John Reynolds. Let's see. Rob says, was the loss of the war by the South inevitable? Was there a political military strategy the South could have used to win the war? Well, I don't know. I'm not a real military historian. I mean, in terms of strategy and all that, I do know that. The British thought all along that the South was going to win because they thought the British generals were so superior to the Union generals that they didn't quite realize the overwhelming money and power of the Northern economy, I don't think, and then the fact that the population was more than double the population of the South, and they had conscription and mercenaries and all that. But after the war, somebody asked General Robert E. Lee who was the most effective soldier in the army, and he said General Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was basically a guerrilla fighter. And so, but all the other generals, not all the other generals, but most of them, certainly the most important ones, were all trained at West Point in Napoleonic warfare. That's why you had these obscene scenes, like in the movie Gettysburg, of, you know, one 10,000 man army versus a 13,000 man army, you know, charging into the teeth of all the cannon and rifle pits, and, you know, with a massive slaughter. Forrest was a guerrilla fighter, and so were people like John Singleton Mosby. And so I think there was a political battle between the West Pointers who wanted to practice traditional warfare and these guerrilla fighters, and had Lee given more power and more troops to the guerrilla fighters, who knows what would have happened. The big mistake they made, I think, is that a lot of these military men didn't really fully realize until late in the war that the technology had changed so substantially from the time they were at West Point. When they were at West Point, you know, a rifle, a musket, was not very accurate at all past 100 yards, if 100 yards. And so the tactic was to run within 100 yards or so, get off a shot, and then charge, you know, try to overwhelm the opponent. But by the time you get to the 1862, 1863, the rifles were accurate for 300 yards or more, and the cannon were rifle cannon now. And so they were pretty darn accurate a mile away or a lot farther. And so a lot of these generals didn't seem to realize this. And so they kept at what they were taught at West Point, you know, from what I've read. And so that's why there was so much carnage. And it's really incredible. A lot of people in the world didn't realize this, even in World War One. If you read about the French soldiers in World War One, you know, proud sons of Napoleon, getting chopped down by machine guns by the tens of thousands. It's just mind-boggling that this would happen. That's warfare, though. That's what happened. Let's see. What other questions I can read here? Higgs is great, Dennis. Yeah, I agree. He's a great scholar. Let's see. Let's see, Erica, why didn't Jefferson Davis give Jackson more men and win the war by taking D.C.? Well, this was the very first battle of the war. There was uncertainty, I guess. I don't know why he didn't, but the first time I read that, though, in a book on Jackson, it's one of those things that, you know, holy cow, boy, that would have really changed history if he had given Jackson 10,000 men. But he didn't know who Jackson was. Jackson wasn't Stonewall Jackson at the time. He was a physics professor at VMI, Virginia Military Institute, and he was known as a very peculiar fellow. He would memorize. They called it natural science, it was physics, and he was known that he would memorize the physics lectures. And if a student would raise his hand and ask a question, Thomas Jackson would do his best to answer it. But then he would have to go back to the beginning of the lecture and start all over again, because he memorized every lecture, and he was known to be just a weird bird. He also taught artillery at VMI, And so here's Jefferson Davis, and this weird guy who he didn't really know at the time comes up to him and proposes this, and so he didn't do that. But Jackson, you know, he later became known as a military genius, and I'm told that to this day they still teach his tactics at West Point, and bring West Point cadets out to the battlefields sometimes on field trips to teach them these things. Let's see, where are we? Dennis, freeing the slaves might have helped their cause. There was a battle over that for years. Robert E. Lee proposed at the very beginning of the war to free the slaves and give them freedom in response for helping with the army. And he battled the politicians of that for years. They finally decided to do it at the end of the war. So at the end of the war, the Confederate government did tell the slaves, if you want to participate in the war and the army, you will be free. But then the war ended, so it was too late. So Lee finally won the argument, but by then it was late 1864, and it was just too late. Let's see. Foote writes that Davis admitted he should have had put Forrest in charge of the Western Army of Tennessee. Okay. See, Dennis, Foote also says that Longstreet anticipated the advent of trench warfare. That's true. I read that. And Shelby Foote really knew what he was talking about. He was really a great writer. Let's see. Yeah, Charles had different questions. I didn't get the Charles question in the forum. Let me see. I have additional questions about the 14th Amendment. Go ahead and write it in. Yeah, Dennis said Patrick Cleburne also pushed. Yeah, it wasn't just Lee. There were other Confederates who said free the slaves and we'll win the war. They finally decided to do it. The 14th Amendment, I can talk about the 14th Amendment, I guess. There's some old great books that talk about this. There's a historian named W. Archibald Dunning, D-U-N-N-I-N-G. He was a professor at Columbia University around the turn of the 20th century, and he produced a number of excellent students. I read all these books on Reconstruction mostly. But he himself, Dunning, was a great historian. And he has two books that are still in print somewhere. I got them out of my university library on the Civil War and the Civil War and Reconstruction. And he tells the whole story of the 14th Amendment. The Southern states were kicked out of the Union and were told that they won't be let back in unless they vote in favor of the 14th Amendment. And so several of them did. And they got enough states, you know, you need three-fourths of the states in the constitutional amendment process. But then after this happened, West Virginia and Oregon withdrew their support. They took a revote and withdrew their support because they objected to the sort of the kangaroo court way in which the southern states were being railroaded into passing the 14th Amendment. So the 14th Amendment never was legally ratified at that time, but the United States Senate just declared it to be the law of the land anyway. And so that's a good example of how the government has enough guns with which to enforce its edicts, therefore it will enforce its edicts, whether they're consistent with the law and the Constitution or not. And that was a very bad precedent to set as far as that goes. So I'm not sure exactly what the question is about the 14th Amendment, but that's one thing I know about it. And Dunning tells the whole story. As do other people. You can find this in a lot of discussion of the 14th Amendment. Charles' question. The reading for this week was noted by Ostrowski. The Supreme Court has never actually ruled on the constitutionality of secession. How important is the precedent set by Lincoln for future considerations of such an act? Would the 14th Amendment have to be canceled in order for the 9th and 10th Amendments to be realized? I don't think so. The way the government Yeah, the where we are now is the government doesn't really take the Constitution seriously at all. If they do, they would listen to Ron Paul and not make fun of him and ridicule him for it. And so Ostrowski, yeah, he's a really smart lawyer and legal scholar. But I don't really know the answer to that question. You'd have to ask a constitutional lawyer, I'm afraid, Charles. Let's see. And Charles put the same question in. Ohio and New Jersey, yes, I think I do recall Ohio and New Jersey. We're also in on that. Was there much commentary about the European from the European press about Lincoln's war crimes as they occurred? I haven't read any. There's another book that Charles Adams, who I mentioned earlier, wrote. It's a book of reprints of essays on European opinions of the war. And I reviewed it on lewrockwell.com several years ago. But I don't recall reading much commentary. I don't think they knew much about what was going on. It doesn't seem like it, because I didn't read much commentary in all these essays from a lot of European countries of what was going on. Although I have read that after the war, when Sheridan went over, was invited by the Prussians to give some talks on what happened in the American Civil War, that the Prussians were shocked by this. And they weren't exactly pussycats about warfare, but even they were shocked and horrified over Sheridan's bragging about the mass murder of civilians and the burning down of homes and so forth that went on. And of course, this would happen on a much grander scale in Europe in the 20th century, as far as that goes. So I don't know about it. Might have been. I would have to do some digging. But in all the reading I've done, I haven't seen any much of any European commentary on this. Has there been any interest in making a real Lincoln into a documentary? Well, yeah, I had a wealthy guy who lives in Mississippi who actually funded a documentary of Jefferson Davis that's been shown on PBS stations around the country. Tell me he was interested, but nothing has happened as far as that goes. So, but I've had several people in the television business tell me, why don't we do this? And I say, sure, okay, but nothing comes of it. So I don't know. It might think it would be a crime. Yeah, I might go to jail once and for all. It's on television. Maybe we don't want to go there. We'll keep on looking at there's some questions here. Tim says, I'll be in the judge on Thursday. It's actually going to be broadcast on Monday. On Thursday, I'm going to be we're taping a show on presidents. I'm going to be there, Tom Woods will be there, Walter Williams, and a few other people. And we're all over the country. A couple will be in the studio, the Fox studio in Manhattan. I'm going to be in West Palm Beach, Florida. So I'm going to a Fox affiliate in West Palm, and Tom Woods is going to be in Kansas City. So we're all going to be taping this show simultaneously with Judge Napolitano on Freedom Watch. It'll be broadcast on Monday, President's Day, at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And the theme is we're all going to talk about best and worst presidents, I'm told. And so his producer just asked us to talk about Jefferson, Lincoln, FDR, Ronald Reagan, Wilson, and the rest. So it ought to be pretty interesting. And with people like Walter Williams and Tom Woods on there, it should be a lot of fun. Fox is pretty good though. And the last time they invited me up to Manhattan, they bought me a first class train ticket on the Amtrak, the government socialist train, which is actually a very convenient way to get from Baltimore to New York City. Let's see. Yeah, people have been reading the spitting match that I've had on lewrockwell.com with this congressman. I'm especially enjoying the fact that apparently yesterday his wife found out that he's divorcing her, and she found out in the media. And so the St. Louis media apparently are all abuzz over this. And in the next several days, there's going to be all kind of bad gossip coming out, apparently. So to me, it'll be fun. Yeah, Martin Van Buren, he was a good guy. As far as all the presidents, Grover Cleveland wasn't bad at all either, compared to the rest. Every time I say something like this, though, I'll get libertarians emailing me, accusing me of defending some particular crime that person committed, as though I think he was a saint. But anyway, well, it seems, let me see if there are any more questions. I'm sort of running out of gas here. Seems like. Any more urgent questions of anybody? Let's see. Oh, Erica, you don't know how testifying at the hearing went. It was a spectacle. You'll have to go to lewrockwell.com and read my article entitled My Associations with Liars, Bigots, and Murderers. And it says something about the hearing. Let's see. Yeah, there are blog posts about it and so forth. Let's see, how can this much history be whitewashed? Well, you know, these facts are all out there. The historians interpret them for us. And so, you know, all these facts that I dig up, there you can get a lot of the mainstream books. I reviewed Eric Foner's latest book in Barron's Magazine, the January 6th issue, The Fiery Trial, it's called. And a lot of the facts that apparently the things Lincoln did are all in there, but the historians all put their own spin on it, and overwhelmingly they put so much spin in the form of rationales and excuse making that it clouds your mind. You think you tend to agree in their interpretation. They put a smile on everything, and so but if you read some of these mainstream books with an eye of just finding out the facts of what happened, judge for yourself whether these are good or bad things that are happening. And so they don't necessarily get away with it, whitewash it forever. Most people are rationally ignorant and too lazy to read about these things. And so, but you people are the exception, obviously. Yeah, government schools, that's for sure. Yeah, this is not talking, it's hard to teach this stuff in government schools because they're government schools, or universities for that matter. Yeah, M. Bean wants to make a documentary based on this class, so maybe we can do it, starting with the cartoon version. Any more questions about the substance in here? Well, it looks like we're kind of running out of gas, guys. I guess maybe we should call it a night. And I thank everybody for showing up. It's been fun once again. We have the last class next week, and I'll work up a quiz for you so you can get a nice A+ on your certificate. And have a good evening and a good week. I'm heading for Florida tomorrow, where it's supposed to be 78 degrees and sunny on the beach. And take care.